This is the Ben Ryan Podcast, part of the Sport Podcast Network.
She was part of the staff that helped South Africa win the Rugby World Cup in 2007. And when Nelson Mandela was introduced to her, he replied, "Of course I know the Eye Lady." 4 years earlier, she was with Sir Clive Woodward's backroom staff as England went on to win the Webb Ellis Cup in Australia. And there's also been stints working with the Pakistani cricket team, helping Formula One drivers achieve focus and NFL players work on the big picture. Not to mention the many one-to-one coaching relationships, including taking Ernie Els to golfing glory at the Open. I'm delighted to say that this week's guest is South African Cheryl Calder. Now, Cheryl's work centres around vision and improving all aspects of that, not just with elite athletes, but also young children and CEOs. We talked about embracing natural talent, seeing the whole picture, sifting what information is useful and what isn't, critical non-essentials and the effect of mobile phones on elite sport and life in general. It's another one of those episodes where we cross into many different sports and skills, and it was fascinating to hear from someone that has gone deep on one very particular skill and how that can influence so many other areas. She knew she had this talent to help others see better very early on as an international hockey player, and she built on that with research and the creation of the iGym, which we explain in more detail later on. But we start at her start, as that young hockey player starting to understand that she had a natural competitive advantage.
Whoever I played against used to always say, "How did you see that? How did you do that?" And I'm like, "Don't you see what I see? Because it's so clear for me." And got to a point where I realized when we got back into international, I played for South Africa and I played some test hockey, and people kept saying that, and I could compete with them even though we'd been isolated for years. And then I realized at a point, because there was actually a GB hockey player whose father used to come watch our matches. Her name was Anna Lawrence, and her dad used to always say, "Wow, you know, where do you get those skills?" And then he wrote me an email one day when I got selected for a team, and he said, "Congratulations, you're the only international hockey player I've ever seen that doesn't run on the field." But as I told you, I played center midfield, and you really run on the field. But that was his perception. That was the wake-up call for me. And then I realized I do see different and I do things different, which I knew all along. Backtracked a little bit, and then everything kind of, the light came on. And I realized as a kid, I challenged myself by playing certain games and experimenting with my vision and my hands. And, you know, how do you do that? And what I inherently was training initially was my skill. So, for example, I wasn't the strongest player on the field. I wasn't physically probably stronger than other players, but I could tackle any player that I competed against. But at the end of the day, it's not about strength. So if you make a tackle in hockey, it's not about strength. It's about timing. So if you get your timing right, you know, you get to the ball at the right time and you read what the opponent is doing, you could probably come out best each time. So my timing was good, which meant I didn't need as much strength. Of course, you do need strength, but it's all about when I approach, how I approach it, what angle I approach, when do I make the tackle. And it's not only then just that ability to time correctly or judge correctly or react correctly, but it's also about reading what my opponent is doing. Some opponents, you know, they always do the same things, so that was easy. So my visual memory used to bring all that stuff back because I could remember how they played. But I also believe in, if you can react to the unexpected, then you can be a great player, because it's fine doing the regular stuff, and that ability you can probably train. But if the opponent I'm playing against suddenly does something else, that I have the ability to read it early or see it early, which means I can respond to what they're doing.
When you say that you saw things differently, what do you mean by that, if I was to dig a little bit deeper?
I probably saw things early. That was probably my biggest skill, which gave me more time to make a decision. I definitely scanned better. I wasn't just in here where most people are all the time. But I think probably the most important skill was the ability to pick up information early.
Do you see that as something that a lot of the elite sportsmen and women that you've come across possess, that ability?
There are lots that don't, but there are special ones who have that ability, but then they lack in another ability. So that's the exciting thing about my work. you actually don't have all these skills. You have strengths and weaknesses in this system, you know, the visual motor system, as you do in the physical system. You know, some guys are faster than others, etc. Some are stronger. In the visual motor system, the same. So we've been working with a couple of Formula One drivers, for example, and one of the top guys we've worked with, obviously can't mention his name, one of the core skills he was lacking is this, it's called visual recognition, it's ability to see something early. And in motor racing, Formula One, you can imagine how important that is. But he, because he was lacking this skill, he kind of developed all the other skills really well. So you can, the elite athletes are an expert at that. So they disregard the ones they're not good at and they use the ones they're really good at. But I believe if you really want to be the best in the world or the, win a World Cup or win a Formula One race, you need all those skills at some point. So we developed the skill for him. And when I still talk to him, when we work with him, I always ask him, let me ask you again, how does this iGEM work affect your performance? And he always says, when I'm in the car, it feels like everything is slow motion. And that's, you know, it's that ability that you really want to have as an elite athlete.
So what did you do with that F1 driver to improve his visual recognition?
So with him, I've attended a lot of Formula One races where I actually go and work with them the week prior to doing the race. So I would do some on-field stuff with him as well. What I do when I go with him, a few days before the race, we walk the track. And I would say to him, when you get here, what would you do? And he would say this. And I would say, visually, this information is important. And between the two of us, we would then calculate what's important.
So effectively, I guess, in that week that you might spend with the driver, you're acting as a personal trainer for the eyes, really.
Exactly that. And, you know, because what we do as individuals, and we're all unique, we all see things differently. I'm fortunate in my work, I know what I think you should be seeing, and I've proven in research this is what you should be doing. And sometimes, you know, as sportsmen, Ben, we actually go blindly through our sport, and we play for our country, and we play World Cups, and we're actually still underperforming. So I really believe I can still make you better. You're great, but I can still make you better because we just use a fraction of our visual motor skills that we actually can be using. You know, so we can all be better than what we are.
I guess from those early kind of light bulb moments as a player where you realised there was something that you had that you could also foster, nurture, and then you wanted to share, I guess, that and with other people. If you kind of fast forward, like I think your first contract was with Surrey in 98, and then you fast forward now to 2021, you've had, you know, huge success, but not just in a vertical, not just in one sport. Like obviously the 2003 Sir Clive Woodward success in the England World Cup, and then backing it up in 2007, Nelson Mandela to call you. Yeah, of course, I know who the eye lady mm-hmm. is when you got mm-hmm. introduced to him. And other successes, you know, Ernie Els, and there's multiple. To get that first, to start on that road, I guess you would have needed to dip into the academic side of things to get some backing into reinforce some of your thoughts. Would that be about right?
That's absolutely correct. So when I was playing hockey and I discovered that I do see different, my first thought was I need to prove it in research because I know it worked for me, but let me prove it because most people are skeptical, and this was a whole new evolution in sports science, and, you know, people don't really trust anything just easily. So I approached a guy called Tim Noakes, the professor at University of Cape Town, and I said, this is what's in my head. And he said, I don't understand what you're saying, but you teach me what you know, and I'll teach you how to research. And then we went on this journey to show that if you use your eyes and your brain and your body in a certain way, that you can impact performance. And that's really where it started. Completed my PhD end of 99. And without that foundation, I can show performance of most of the people I've dealt with, but the basis is the research. So it was great to do. It was tough, but because I was still working, competing, etc. So, but anyway, it was a great experience working under Tim Noakes as well.
What was the most interesting thing that you learned during that research phase?
Really, initially, when I did the research, I presumed that, say, an ice hockey goalkeeper has better reactions than a football player or better than a hockey player. A rugby and ice hockey is probably quite a good comparison. And when I assessed these elite athletes, I found that I did some work with table tennis players at the time, and I used them in my assessment, that I found some rugby players having quicker reaction times than table tennis players. And then I realized it's not about the skill, it's about the individual. And when I, you know, for example, it's I first thought maybe hockey players need this kind of training program and rugby players that, and et cetera. And then I realized, no, it's actually not. It's about the individual. So we all have strengths and weaknesses. And if I can take the individual and equip him to be the best he can be, he will then progress in his, you know, given environment. So that was an eye-opener for me as well, because I kind of logically thought that I would find that certain sports have certain skills which are better. And actually, they aren't. But there are certain individuals that have got better scores than others. I worked with early days, I think 2010, somewhere around there, with the Vancouver Canucks, who were a set of twins in the team. And everyone said, these guys are just amazing. You know, they have that feel, so they know exactly where each other are on the ice. And when I assessed them, they were quite different. And the one guy had skills which the other guy didn't have. So that's really exciting. You know, if they have this feel for where each other on the ice are, you can still improve them. So it's about the individual. That's really what my research came down to. But I did a whole lot of assessments and research on all. I did it on cricket and rugby and table tennis and hockey and et cetera. And I used elite teams because at the time when I was still playing, I had access to elite teams. So, it makes my research real.
How do you learn now?
I always have to think on my feet when I work with the elite athlete and the elite coaches. They're definitely a different species, which I'm sure, Ben, you would know. It's just been thrown out in the environment and a lot of stuff, because I can't go to anyone and say, help me quickly, this is what I'm doing. You know, I've got to think for myself. And the more I get thrown out on my feet, the more I discover new things. It's quite crazy. I was working with I work with a young Italian golfer at the moment, and something happened in the tournament, and I just come across a training drill that I can give him that applies to what's happening with him, and it's a drill I've never given to anyone else. So I think I just delve into those files that lie at the back there and pick up something, and that only happens through the base of research. Having played international sport myself, having worked across the board, and just knowing what they need.
So what exactly happened with that golfer, and what did you do to help?
When he was putting, he felt like he was cutting across the ball, and that he saw the hole as, yeah, and actually it was not quite there. And this is a whole lot of information your eyes are giving you, but he was actually conditioned to think, because a coach would say to him at some point, you're cutting across the ball, or whatever he's doing. So he believes that when the ball goes in that direction, that he's cut the ball. And I was telling him that you're not. And let me do a drill with you to show you that you're not doing it. So I set up a drill where it wasn't possible to cut the ball. So I put tees in certain areas, for example, and he still believed that he was cutting the ball, even though I physically, technically showed him that he wasn't. But it becomes such a mindset, and we do that in our sport all the time. You know, when he misses a putt, his first thought is, I cut the ball, and it's not that. So then it becomes a vicious circle, because if you're cutting the ball, then you maybe change your grip a little bit, or you see different. Maybe you just read the putt wrong, which is the challenge of golf anyway. But the first go-to is my bad technical ability, that I've always done that. You know, sometimes you might not even change something on your technique. You might just think that each time, but then you get under pressure, don't you? You put yourself under pressure. You know, it's a 5-foot putt. Last time I missed it. Oh, hang, I hope I put this putt in, you know. So then these things start happening. And I just bring them down, take all of that away, come back to the core skill, and give them ways of correcting if something does go wrong. So not to think about all the other stuff. This is what you do, and this is how it works. It's as simple as that. That's how it works. And they just fall back on the simple stuff, because it is actually a game of simple principles. And if you apply them, you're probably going to be successful most of the time. And if you misread the putt, great. You move on, and you know, it happens in golf.
When you're talking about that, is that something that comes from your breadth of experience that you've gathered, that information? Can you actually explain why you've used that, or do you just know that it's going to work?
My training really goes about the individual. So I believe that every single person I work with is different. And I think I have, when I played field hockey, I captained a lot of teams and sometimes I coached them. And I had to play and captain and coach and come off at halftime and give a team talk. And I could tell every single player what I thought they needed to do. And I could give us a new tactic or whatever. So I think it's a skill that I learned by doing that. And then having worked, have the belief that you work with an individual and not with the science of what I have. It has taught me to find that something special.
When you're talking about those huddles as a coach, the first thing I'll do is take a breath and look at their body language and see how they're going, how their breathing is. Is that the sort of stuff as well that you'd be?
Absolutely. You know, I have the eye to pick up that information. I could probably give each player a solution to what was happening on the field. So even though I was playing my own position, I could actually go to each player and give them some information that could help them. So it's about reading the situation, knowing where to look, when to look, when not to look also, you know, and taking that information in, processing it as best I can, and then responding and giving back the information.
Would you pass that across to coaches that you're working with if they're not picking up on some of those triggers, some of those cues that you're seeing?
I would. If they're open to it, yes, I would.
Yeah.
Coaches are pretty set in their ways. I think it's so important to have as wide a vision as possible. I've learned a lot from a lot of coaches, what to do and what not to do. But I think you mentioned it earlier, Ben, they get caught on an idea and then they run with that and then they're close to all the other things happening around them, you know.
Yes.
So I'm again the opposite. It's probably my starting point. And then I use what I have.
Yeah, no, I've definitely seen examples of like willful blindness where they'll ignore things, and or confirmation bias as well, where they'll, you know, they'll just do things to confirm what they already think. But I'm fascinated by that if you have, you know, your awareness is heightened because of your ability to just make the most of what you're seeing, and you can then translate that. Does that mean that every time you walk into a room, you can kind of get the vibe very quickly on how people are feeling?
Unfortunately, I do. Fortunate and unfortunate.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wish I could put the switch off and just be normal, but it's in my makeup. It's what I do.
So I'd get that as a coach as well, and you know, particularly on moments where it's, you know, the Friday before a game or the morning of a game, you get a sense from various things. Now, as a coach, if you're a head coach, you can obviously make some changes, have some conversations. If I'm a coach and I've got a consultant coming in from the outside, how difficult must it be for you to decide on when to step in and say something and when to step back and look?
I always act professionally. So if I have the freedom to do it, I've got to make sure I won't say anything unless I'm 120% certain. Sometimes it's good stuff that I see, you know, and I want to say to the player, that's looking great. I remember, if I can mention one example, I remember walking to breakfast on the day of the Rugby World Cup final in Sydney, Australia, and seeing Johnny and just seeing in his eyes, he's ready to go. You know, so I remember that picture so vividly. So it's not always negative stuff you see. Sometimes it's really good stuff. And I think it's important for players, if you see something good, to say. I wouldn't on a match day probably say anything. If it was the Friday, maybe.
Yeah. And you said that you saw in Johnny Wilkinson's eyes on the day of the Rugby World Cup final that he was ready to go. What do eyes look like when they're ready to go?
I don't know if it's going to make sense. Relaxed, but intense. Focused, but aware. I've seen it in a few players in, you know, wherever I've worked, but it's so hard to explain, but you could be there, you know, some guys, I mean, in that environment, we're all different characters. So some guys would really just joke about all the time on a really, you know, World Cup final day. But I think he had the ability to relax, but also stay focused, you know. So I walk into these environments and I can feel something happening. I remember with Ernie, we got to Lytham on the Monday after the Scottish Open, and Ernie and I both said to each other almost at the same time, "Oh, we've got a good feeling. You know, we've got a good feeling about this." And there's no reason for Ernie to win that major at that point where he was in his performance. And I just remember that. But it's not just a feeling. It's a culmination of preparation, doing the right stuff, behaving, eating, you know, everything in the right way, which then comes together. So it's that which I see.
How do you get from what you're seeing to what you're feeling?
I come from working with All Blacks, working with the Boks, the Springboks, in the four-year build-up to this World Cup, or 4-6 years build-up to this World Cup. And when I got to England, I recognised that they were doing things that were important for a team to win. The way they behaved themselves, the way they approached people, what they did on the field, how they trained intensely, how everyone was focused. So I recognised that what I've already learned from other teams and what I was seeing here, it was the right ingredient, and that those ingredients is what I think you need to win a World Cup.
You said you had similar experiences with South African golfer Ernie Els.
I could see it in his eyes as well. I mean, it probably sounds crazy to people out there, but it's also that something that I can perform. But I think I have in my science the ability to train people to get to that point. I can prepare you to get to that point. It doesn't happen overnight. It's not a quick fix, like I've always said. But if you want to go out and win a World Cup and you want to go win a major, I really believe I can take people to do that.
What's the first thing you would do going into an environment?
I would change it on my gut.
Yeah.
Or what I experience. I remember, let's use England rugby as an example. I was obviously working with All Blacks, and Clive approached me, et cetera, et cetera. And then eventually flew over to London. And I remember arriving on that early flight from South Africa, early morning, winter. And I walked into this big hall area at Peniel Park. And the whole team was sitting there, the whole management. There were a few people as well. And I just remember, okay, looked around the room. And anyway, the easy thing for me is it worked for me. I've proven it in research. I've proven it with people I've worked with. So I don't worry about that. I know it works. And all I do is I'm an expert at what I do. If I'm a guy or a girl or a coach or a scientist or whatever, I want to improve your performance, and I know I can improve it, and this is what I do. All the teams and wherever I've worked, I've really been accepted and from the start. And, you know, all I say, just give me an opportunity to show you what I do, and then we'll go from there.
And if I was working in one of those organisations as a coach, and I brought you in to consult, I imagine I'd be bringing you in because I know, in kind of GB rowing terms, it makes the boat go faster. You know, you're going to improve performance, and ultimately, you know, that's why you'd bring. That's my view of bringing anyone in from the outside is it's going to improve performance. Would you also, one of the other things that I'd also look to do is create guardrails around what your role and responsibilities are. Have you had that before with coaches where they've gone in, okay, this is your role, this is where I would, you know, I'm really open to you perhaps talking to me and telling me about what you're seeing whenever you want, but putting guardrails in place so that you're not creating any fog or grey that might create some disagreement?
Yeah, I agree. So I still have that philosophy when I go in. I never say something unless I've consulted with a coach. So I try to, you know, just stick to the real protocols. For me as a scientist and for them as a team and a coach, I coached quite at a high level in field hockey. So I respect, you know, what I would have liked as a coach. So I've been on kind of all those environments where I've done stuff which those people are doing. So I would never say anything unless I've consulted with a coach. So that's my starting point.
Yeah. And even though, what about if there's a moment where there's something that you feel is absolutely critical to intervene, would you then go to the coach and say?
I would.
And if the coach wasn't around?
I would do it.
Yeah.
I would do it. But I'd do it with, I'd be really careful. And Ben, you know, you can talk to some players, others you can't. Mm. So that would be my first sort of departure point. Can I talk to this guy? No, he's not the kind of guy you can talk to. You can talk through the coach. Some guys you can talk directly to. So it's again that, you know, which I think you know a little bit about, that feeling of what you can do when.
Absolutely. And would you say then that leads to you perhaps unearthing some, I guess the term is cultural architects, where there's people in the team that immediately see the value they bring and kind of share that positivity around you, and it floods through the team?
Absolutely. I mean, Brian Banner, probably a good example. Mm. You know, he always had the phrase, "Thanks for making my eyes as fast as my feet." And
that's pretty quick. Pretty quick then.
Yeah. So anyway, so, you know, they did all those intercepts, him and Jean de Villiers and those guys, and they were such believers in what I did. And, you know, they were two leaders in the team. And so that also helps. It also helps.
What kind of things did you do with Habana or Jean de Villiers to get them to the point where they had a great ability to create interceptions?
One of the important visual motor skills is, and a really important skill for an elite athlete to have, a really important skill for anyone to have, is the ability to pick up information early. Some of the greatest batsmen in the world, that you have that concept that they have a lot of time to play their shots. And it's not because they have more time than anyone else. It's the fact that they pick up information early. So the earlier you pick it up, then you have more time. I mean, the ball's coming at the same speed for you and for me and for all those guys. And now with Habana and Jean de Villiers, we made them recognize something earlier. And we actually worked out in rugby, if I make you see it half a second quicker, I'll buy 4 meters for you. And if I give you a second more time to pick up information, I'll buy you 8 meters. Now, you can imagine in rugby, that's quite important. So my early days when I worked for the Springboks as well, all the players get assessed on concussion tests at the beginning of a season. It was just routine. I'm not sure if it's today still. But one of the guys who played, one of the locks, when he went for his retest, we actually found that he had improved his, not reaction time, his ability to pick up information earlier by 1.42 seconds. Now we're buying that guy, you know, 3 times 4 meters. So we're buying it 12 meters. But it's also the ability to pick up information of people around you. And that's really what Habana and Jean de Villiers did. They just, and if you go back to the videos, it looks like they did it in slow-mo, but it was just, they got their timing right, picking up early. But then there are other factors that play a role. You've got to judge depth, you've got to get your timing right, get the timing of your run right, etc. The core skill was something called visual recognition, and it's the ability to pick up information really early.
And is that, so if you want to kind of lay out that process to us, and it doesn't necessarily have, it could be anyone, but in my head I've got Brian, if you kind of give us a day in the life, or perhaps how you iterate across a week, how you might embed what you do with a player or a team?
So it depends if I'm working full-time with them or if I work on a part-time basis with them. When I worked with Habana and the Springboks, I was in a full-time capacity. So we used to do our gym training. I called it our gym, for a better word. And we used to break the groups up, and when the backs went to physical gym, the forwards went to our gym. And we have the software program where I monitor and train and assess and et cetera. So they would come to the R gym and then swap it around. So we'd have a schedule in the week. We would do it a minimum of 3 times a week. However, the players had access every day. So if they wanted to do it on their own, they could do that as well. And then I would, part of my job is consulting. So when we go to the field, through my assessments, I know all the strengths and weaknesses of every player. So I would then work on field specific with training drills to enhance that ability. So the easy way to do, so in the I gym, I would train depth. And then on the field, I would make areas. And under pressure, I would ask players to put the ball in certain areas. Because we're very forgiving as coaches, or as commentators, or even worse. But we will say, that was a good kick. But actually it wasn't, because we didn't have the end result. But a lot of players, and especially because we're spending so much time on digital devices, our ability to judge depth is deteriorating. So if you kick the ball 2 meters too long and Brian Banner doesn't get there, then it's too long. So if I can make sure that every player, say the kickers, make sure they put the ball exactly where it should be, the consequent of Brian Abana timing his run and getting to the ball, etc., it would all come together. And with that 2007 World Cup team, we, with Percy Montgomery, for example, he was really bad under high balls. And it took me about a year and a half to teach him to see depth. People used to exploit that, for example. They would, when he was still a younger player, always kick a high ball on him, and they know that he's under pressure. And the players who are playing with him think exactly the same. So what would they do? They would go back and support him. But at the 2007 World Cup, he didn't drop one high ball. And the players playing with him knew that. So they didn't go back and get close to him. They knew that they could wait here for him, and it changed the whole attack. So it's tiny little stuff that the normal guy watching doesn't pick up. And I always have a belief that when I do any training with any player, there's always got to be a decision-making component to it, because that simulates what happens on, you know, on the field or in life or whatever you do. And I also insisted on having time alone with the players. So I also need, like the scrum coach has his session, I need my vision session as well. And if the coaches endorse that, the players know it's real. If they just take you as a consultant and they just throw you in just to keep the players busy, or, Ben, you know what happens in coaching, then you're doing a kind of a disrespect to me and to my science. So those visionary coaches see that it's going to make a difference, and they give me freedom to do what I think is important.
That makes perfect sense. If I move it forward a little bit, you've embedded some of the skills and training to improve their vision, and they're using it in practical terms. There's obviously an outcome to everything, whether it's a success or a failure. For example, let's take some of the stuff, a recent review I did at GB Shooting, and they were talking about distraction techniques that they use in their shooting. So things they'll do to put off the shooter to stop them doing the things that I guess you're helping them get better at. Do you then have tools and things to help you get that distraction back on track?
I equip the player to work under any conditions, because believe me, sport, really do you find yourself in the ideal condition. You know, there's either an opponent or an injury or something in your back of your head that's happened before, etc. So I empower him to, doesn't matter what the environment is, to play under those conditions. And I believe that our gym actually, or my science, trains you how to get in the zone. You know, so you physically train how to perform under pressure. That's really what it is. It's a really simple concept. So it would be like a pressure putt. So for example, Ernie, he wouldn't not have been there before because he's been training this, just like people go to a normal gym. You know, if a front row is not strong enough to handle the scrum and he hadn't gone to the gym ever, he's not going to be able to perform. And exactly the same with all these athletes that I work with, they actually train to perform on the field. And for example, with Ernie, when we get on the putting green or in the game, short game, whatever we do, I teach him what he needs to do, which is specific to to Ernie else, which I said is different to everyone else. So with Ernie, when he started putting, we changed ball position, we changed stroke, we did all those stuff, but specific to Ernie. So it wouldn't work for you, Ben, and it wouldn't work for me, because we're all different. And the third part is what I do. I empower players and athletes to correct themselves. So if something goes wrong with a putt, Ernie immediately knew, this is what I did. On the next putt, it's not, oh, I hope I don't miss, you know, that kind of thing. I know what I did wrong, so this is how I corrected. So those are the components that I work on.
Yeah, and there's a ripple effect, I guess. And we touched upon the iGym and how you use that to help improve. Could you tell us exactly what's in the iGym?
The easiest way to explain it and for people to understand that if you are physically a fitter person, it improves the quality of your life. Now, exactly the same. If your eyes and your brain are fitter and function better, you're a better person. So it affects your wellness. It affects relationships even, because there are behavioral changes which happen. It affects your driving ability. So everything you do is affected. So in the iGym is a combination of all the skills that you need to perform, be it a Formula One driver, be it yourself in your job, Ben, be it a big corporate, an executive working. We did some work with Clifford Chance in London, one of the big law firms, be it a guy making decisions on his feet. So it's a gym for your eyes and your brain, as simple as that. So we've put in all the skills that you need. However, when you do a certain drill, when you go in, it would test and train that ability. But because we're using a lot of other abilities, it would also use a lot of other skills. But we say, for example, we want to do visual recognition, which we've just spoken about. Then I would put something on the screen and ask them to repeat what they've just seen. It might be something they have to follow. It might be something that just flashes up. It might be something on a rugby ball. It might be a certain player on the field. And you would then have to give the answer. So in everything you train, you would be training how you take information in, how quickly you process it, and how quickly you respond. Now, you can imagine if the information you're taking in is too slow, inaccurate, incorrect, there is absolutely no way you're going to end up with a good decision at the end. So we first train that, and then we train how you process information in the brain, either accurately, quickly. Scanning would be a really good example. How much information do I take in when I look at the field, and how quickly can I tell my body that's the response I've got to go to? So in the iGym, in a 10-minute training session, you'd probably make between 600 and 800 decisions based on something you haven't seen before. Now, you can imagine just doing this continuously, and the drills are never the same. You can never anticipate, you can never preempt what you're going to see. You've got to see it, you've got to process it, and you've got to respond. And that's why we have such amazing results, because we're pushing you to a limit which is way beyond what you experience on the field. So by the time you get back onto the field, everything seems like really easy. So in essence, just a gym program for your eyes and your brain.
And what happens when, I imagine you probably agree, a correct tackle is not about technique. It's about making sure that you've got that, you've seen the tackle right to start with, and then you get your technique comes into play. Often I see it on many occasions where somebody gets something wrong, particularly in rugby, where there's a lot of collisions, and then they'll overplay a strength, which is just try and hit harder next time. How do you work with people that have, like, they've missed a goal, a kick at goal, or they've missed a tackle, or they've done something that they've made an error? That obviously then distracts them in their thinking, and then that contributes towards not seeing the picture. Yeah. Is there any techniques that maybe you could suggest that people could use to help them get back on track if they do something that they failed at in the short term?
So a very simple philosophy from our science. If, say, missing a tackle, I often think it's got to do with judgment. So if my judgment skills are not up to standard and I never do anything about it, I'm still going to be missing 4 out of 10. I'll do 6 good ones, or maybe 3 out of 10. But if I train with you, I don't want you to miss any. And I believe that if I train you well enough, you always have that ability to do it well. So I always say to the player, have you equipped yourself to perform better? And what have you done this season to make yourself better than you were last season? You know, we're all evolving, the game is evolving, and we tend to always just do what we've always done. So I believe that if he's equipped to do whatever he has to do on the field, if he does miss a tackle, sometimes you have to acknowledge and put it down to the player you're playing against and say, you know, great move or whatever, and just move on. Know that I empower you to know that you have trained to do that and you have the ability, we've practiced it, you just put it into play. And golf, I always say, is not a game of perfect, and you are going to miss a putt because you didn't read it correctly. It doesn't mean your stroke's not good. But you know what golfers often think? Oh, my goodness, there's something wrong with my stroke. So they make an adjustment. And in fact, there was nothing wrong with your stroke. You know, it was just not a good read. So just teach the player that mistakes do happen, but really, I've equipped you to be the best you can be.
But I guess you still want to learn from that as well. So would you then go off the field and when all the game's over, then start to deconstruct?
Of course I would, yes. And I love doing that. That's probably, you know, I love finding ways of telling the player how to do it. But then had we trained it, had we gone through that whole process, next time we do it differently. So we we just always make sure we get better. And I believe there's no roof. You can always get better than what you are.
If I look over to my left-hand side, I'm in my flat in Southwest London, and my partner Michelle loves Columbo. Do you ever feel there's an element of you being a detective to find those clues to unlock the potential for those individuals?
I do it all the time. It's in my soul. It's what I do, and I love doing it. And I've worked with so many players, not just on their technical ability or their sporting skill, but also on what's important for him as an individual and, you know, what makes him function. We're all so different. And I just think having worked with so many cultures, Ben, it has helped me as well, because I've had to adapt to all kinds of conditions. You know, I worked with Pakistan cricket as early as 98. You know, I was really still trying to develop my science and so on. I worked with some of the great cricketers, Wasim Akram, Waqar Yunus, Shoaib Akhtar, you know, all those guys. And I had to adapt to certain conditions, but they still accepted me in their group, and, you know, we worked hard. Saeed Anwar, the opening back, there's old story I have with helping him perform. So it's about understanding people and having your eyes open to whatever's happening, you know, not just coming in and just worried about yourself. But it's hard work, actually, to pick up all these cues. But if I want you to be a better player, I'll do everything in my power to make you better.
How much then does your ability to be able to see things instruct your ability to be able to listen?
Very important. And I think it's probably one of the big things lacking in elite sport. Everyone wants to talk. They tell their story, you know, and talk what they want done and so on. And I think sometimes you need to just sit back and look. You probably don't even have to listen. If you just look, you'll pick up information. And obviously, if you listen, you pick up that extra information.
Is that a byproduct then of some of the stuff that you do? And at the end of this, we'll have a show notes with links to the IGM. But would you say it's a byproduct that if you become good at what you're seeing, ultimately that's going to improve your ability to listen correctly?
Yeah, I think so. I think, it's been proven that 80 to 90% of information you take in is visual, that you base a decision on. So there I already have that advantage. And then if you listen, and use the other senses, you know, then you use skills which are there for you to use. So why not use them? You know, so I think seeing or looking or scanning or whatever you want to vision, whatever you want to call it, is important in any environment you go into.
Would you know how much percentage the average person has the ability to act on? Or is it more that your work opens it up to 90 to 100%?
Look, the other senses play a percentage, you know, hearing or responding to what you hear, etc. So between 80 and 90%, the rest are the other senses that we use. That ability is trainable. The percentage that we use, Ben, I think, depends on the individual. And I think today people are using less and less. So because the awareness is deteriorating, that ability is also deteriorating. So we rely on maybe hearing more. We just don't look anymore. You know, we just kind of, simple terms, we've lost our awareness. So we don't look for anything specific.
Going back to I keep thinking in my head about how I would utilize your skills as a coach. You know, I would want to improve my ability to recognize cues in players, how they look, how they feel, that then can start a conversation with them to try to help get them to stay at their best version with skill. Is there stuff that you've done with coaches there? And what kind of things would you do to help them improve that visual awareness?
IGM really helps you think on your feet, and coaches have to do that all the time. And you know, in the pressure of coaching, you sometimes get a little bit of tunnel vision. So the ability to stay open, if you train your eyes and your brain and decision-making, which coaches need, you're improving that skill. And you use that in the game all the time. We did some work with the Miami Dolphins. I'm not sure if you attended any of those American football games, Ben, have you?
I have. I've been lucky to be involved in come and spent a day with a few different NFL teams.
I mean, these stadiums are huge. And some of the coaches sit really high up in a box, and they send information down to the guys at the bottom. So we train with some of the Miami Dolphin coaches and the guys who have to make a decision on what they're seeing on the field, who's coming off, who's going on, and et cetera, and send that information down to the field. And we had great success with that. So it's just about thinking on your feet, making a decision under pressure.
If we stick with that American theme, I've been not staggered, but I guess I was taken a little bit aback in some of the changing rooms or dressing rooms or training grounds that I've been in with American sporting teams where they're on their phones before the game, halftime, in between the quarters, and they're allowed to do it because they're treated like adults. There's a lot of player power in some of the leagues. Yet there must be, and I've read a bit about your views on this, and there must be something that would detract from their visual performance by being down here looking at a mobile phone. Have you ever come across that, and how have you managed to persuade those players not to stick out a tweet at half time or read something before a game on their phone and do some IGN work, for example?
Yeah. So you as a player, if you say the players are adult and they can make their own decisions, if you are prepared to deteriorate your skill just to get on your phone, then you must take the consequences of that. So I'm totally against it. I think we are busy killing our eyes and our brains. And in 20, 30 years' time, we're going to say, oh, my goodness, why did no one do anything about it? So I fight the battle pretty on my own. But I've seen a decline in skill level in the elite player in the last 7-8 years. And it's not just what I see. We actually assess players, so I can see the deterioration in certain skills. I have no doubt that if you train to be in here all the time on your mobile smartphone, if you train to be in here all the time, like any skill that you train, if you train to be here all the time, that's how you're going to perform. So if you train to do a certain skill, you're going to get better at it. And just like you're training to be in here. And I mean, we've worked out some players spend about 10 hours on their phone in a day. Now they're training to be here. Now you expect them to go out on the field and look like this and judge, and we're losing our awareness, we're losing our ability to judge. There are no eye movements happening. So we're training to work on a small screen, and that's not what sport is about. So if you just take that philosophy for a start, never mind all the other adverse effects of filling your brain with information which has no relevance to your performance, then I mean, I can talk for hours about it. I think it's the teams I deal with, I show them the negative effects of this, and then they have to make a decision as a team. No phones in the change room. With some of the teams, we have no phones match day, that kind of thing. And they've had great success.
I'm a massive advocate of that as well, and before the Olympics, I think for about 10 days, we didn't have phones. And
fantastic.
The British women's hockey team that also won gold in Rio didn't have phones before that. And often for me, that's controlling the controllables, because there's information you might see on your phone that you don't want to see. But I definitely wasn't as aware of making the link between being on your phone and having a lack of vision on the field, but it makes absolute sense. Is there anything you've got from experience or research that talks about maybe the lag? So if you're on your phone half an hour before the game or an hour before the game and you change room, a lot of teams get there early, they get the program, they have a little look around, they wander around, they're on their phone. Is there then a lag, do you think, between when you come off your phone to when you go onto the field, that's almost like that moment where there's a transition period where your vision's down?
I think that little bit you spend there is not really the issue. The issue is the 5 hours a day, 5 days a week, 25 hours on your phone, on a small screen, when you want to perform and judge and see in your peripheral and respond and react and so on. So that little bit, if you've spent 50 hours in the week, you're going to have huge deficits. It might be one ball you drop in, but it might be the ball that loses the World Cup or the match or the Six Nations or whatever. But we get forgiven as sportsmen so easily. I mean, I listen to the commentators who say, oh, that was a great pass. It wasn't a great pass. The guy picked up the ball, yeah. And that was, well caught. Actually, that's your job. You should be catching a ball like that. But we drop such easy passes, catches nowadays, and we get forgiven for them. And I think there is a great role in smartphone use, where you're training to work on a small screen. I mean, take when you were a kid and you had a rugby coach who said, go into the gym, there's a tiny little screen in the gym. Go spend 5 hours looking at stuff on that screen. I mean, you'd tell him you're crazy, yeah. Aren't you?
Yeah.
But we're doing it. And then one of the big things as well, other than small screen and affecting judgment and movements and awareness and reactions and coordination, a lot of the players go on at night when they get into bed because they've got nothing else to do. They're in hotel rooms, etc. The blue light is actually a sign to say, please don't go to sleep. You know, so where our sleep patterns are affected, there's just tons of stuff happening. So if I was a sporting team, I would set some rules in place, some teamship rules to make us perform better.
And would that be your tip if someone's listening to this podcast that's maybe not an elite coach, but a parent or a young athlete? Or what tip would you give to them to try to get off their phone a little bit more?
Yeah, you just need to monitor it. I mean, I know that Apple, they've got screen time reports that come in everywhere. I mean, you can look at that. I know that iGym is an antidote, you know, so you need to train or use your eyes in a way where they were designed to be used. So I would find ways of using less time and finding ways of improving that ability. And, you know, in this year we've just been through, we've all been on Zoom and laptops and phones, and we've probably spent many hours more than we did the previous year. And I've had a lot of people that have really said to me, I'm not sure what's going on, you know, brain fog, eye fog, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's probably from just spending too much time indoors and on screens and so on.
I like applying Pareto's principle to a lot of things. So try to find your golden signals in things, in what you're doing in your culture and your environment. Is there one thing that you would say makes the biggest difference in what you're doing to achieving success?
If I make you 1% better than you were, and I have no doubt I'm probably going to make you better than that, I've improved your performance and I've made you a better player to perform better. And even if you only do one thing on the field better than you did before, then I've achieved my objective. So it's not about the many things you do correctly or better, it's that one thing that actually makes a difference. So we're always so inclined to look for big differences. I mean, Clive Woodward always spoke about the critical non-essentials, which was the work that I did. So I think looking for those critical things that make a big difference and not the big things that make a little difference, I would say, are important.
And we talked about the iGym. I used it last night, actually. And
I saw you went on.
and I'll use it again. I really enjoyed it. Although I got judged I think I put my age in wrong. So I was judged against 20 to 30 year olds. So I was a little
but you're
bit.
You're probably good enough.
I'm not sure these days. But where can people go to find out more about the iGym? We'll stick it in our show notes as well at the end.
Yeah, iGym.com. As simple as that. We work with kids from 6 years old, and we work with people in their 90s.
Yeah.
So we had an old guy want to redo his driver's license. He was 96 and he wanted to improve his reaction time. So we've worked with that. And we work with a lot of kids on learning skills, reading skills, comprehension skills, so better academic results. And really as an antidote to what we're doing in life today with all these tiny screens and too much overload of information and so on.
How do you help then a young child read better? Is it exactly how you just explained it, really, and just use the iGym for them to read quicker, pick out the right words?
Yeah. So the eyes do two movements. They do a track movement and they do something called a saccade. I just use term it as an eye jump because people understand it better. So you read, you need to follow. Some people read ahead and jump lines, etc. But the two core skills, ability to follow, ability to move your eyes so when you get to the end of a sentence that you can come back and go down to the next line. Now, if that ability is not good enough, kids would read, and when they come down to the next line, they've actually skipped three lines. So they're reading, they're not contextually reading what's happening. And then they would have to go back again. And so the eyes get tired as you keep doing all this. So we just make sure that the eye tracks correctly. And while you're doing that, you're comprehending information and remembering it. It's something called visual memory. And we make sure that the eye jumps are circades are up to standard, so that when you jump to the next line, you go exactly where you should be, and it's quick and it's accurate. So they read quicker, they take more information in a shorter time and give it back more effectively, as simple as that. You know, so if your kid can't read, it's not because they can't read, it's not because there's something wrong with them, it's just their skills have deteriorated. And that's why I think kids should play outside and look around and use their eyes. And we just spend too much time on digital devices, and the eyes were never designed to do that. So get them to go outside and throw a ball, let them follow a ball, you know, let them roll a ball at something, let them walk on a fence and fall off and get back, because you're learning all these visual motor skills. So I would just say, just look after, be so aware of what you're doing and how you're using your eyes and your brain and what you're doing out there. Open your peripheral, have awareness, practice with yourself all the time, you know, sit somewhere and see how wide you can see. But if you don't train that ability, it deteriorates. So it's as simple as that.
Look, I know you're you know, a household name amongst the sporting fraternity in South Africa, but it's been a real delight to talk to you and hopefully get your message out to the wider public as well. So Cheryl, look, thank you so much for your time today. You've been brilliant. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Ben. It's cool chatting to you.
I've chatted to other guests about the importance of listening and making sure you're understanding and not just hearing. I guess much of Cheryl's work is on making sure we aren't just looking, but really seeing. Performing in whatever you do will be better if you're seeing the whole picture, and picking up on the visual cues is as good a start point as any. I remember while coaching the England Sevens team, getting that skill wrong. Before the Hong Kong Sevens final, where we were due to play New Zealand, I'd had a bit of time to watch our winning semi-final and also New Zealand's game, and I saw a few areas I thought we could expose, but I was looking at the wrong things. Our attacking breakdown work had just been pretty loose. We were too high, but I didn't spot it, and New Zealand dismantled us in that area, giving us no chance and having to play off no more than just scraps of possession. It taught me a good lesson that day that led me to change the way I would then analyse everything after each match, but it also reminded me to put more emphasis on my vision. Don't assume it's always there, seeing all that counts at that moment. I had prided myself on normally being able to see those small moments that others didn't, to give the teams I was with an edge. But the pressure had unknowingly narrowed my sight physically, but it also led to a narrowing in my coaching craft, which meant I just wasn't seeing clearly. I would like to think that I've been really good at recognising potential stumbling blocks like that since. But like every skill you have, you need to keep practicing it, and you need to put some deliberate thought around it. Being able to see opportunities, ideally earlier and in full technicolor, is vital for all of us to give us that signal that we need to make great decisions. After chatting to Cheryl, I went straight onto her iGym. It's a lot of fun and it makes you really think about what you're doing, and you can find it at igym.com. It's the best place as well to find out more about what Cheryl does and to reach out to her and her team. She is another of these practitioners that flies largely under the radar, but really makes an impact. I was really grateful to chat about everything we just did, and hope you all have some further food for thought to think about. The show notes will provide lots more detail and relevant links to anything we signposted or referenced, and you can find those at benryan.co.uk/podcast. And it'd be great if you press that subscribe button on the usual platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Amazon Music, and Google Podcasts. And please don't forget to rate and review us to help us get noticed by those like-minded listeners.